Please don't worry about offending me by going, God, it's so boring. What is the most boring thing that people ask? It's like if you're at a dinner party and someone...
I think the most offensive and the most sort of the first thing that people ask is they usually ask you to tell, say, the worst or most gross thing that's happened to you.
Oh. Welcome to Sex Power Money. My name is Sarah Pascoe and today I'm talking to two incredible women. There's Charlotte Rose, who is a multi-award-winning sex worker, sexual trainer, political activist, broadcaster and presenter. Charlotte's been involved in the adult industry for over 20 years, as well as being a passionate activist. I'm also talking to Eliza Harper, who became a sex worker after her disabilities caused her to give up her corporate career. Eliza, again, is a passionate activist. She's petitioned local and national government in support of the decriminalisation of sex work. In our conversation today, we talk about their lives, their opinions and experiences selling sex. We talk about the continued stigma around the people who sell sex. And we also touch upon Lily Allen and bum fingering.
Really think that's awful.
Yeah, it's awful. So, but you know what? It's not similar in the kind of the level of offensiveness, but in terms of the obviousness, comedians always get asked their worst heckle.
Yeah, yeah.
And it comes from the same place. People think that's going to be the most interesting story you can tell.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Usually it's just a really bad day at work.
Yeah.
I think for me, it starts right at the beginning, because when I introduce myself as a sex worker, they go, A what?
Yes.
Yeah, a sex worker. A prostitute.
Yes.
Yes, sex worker, yeah.
So you you tell everyone you're a sex worker.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, everywhere you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And so actually that's...
I walk around.
Yes.
I don't mind. I've got an amazing T-shirt that's got a tick list. So it's whore, panty seller, cam girl, dominatrix, prostitute, street worker, and then it says at the bottom, I'm a proud sex worker.
Yeah.
So it ticks all the boxes.
Yes.
And
did you get that made?
No. So it's just like this one. I got this one from a sex worker event in Nepal.
Yeah.
And I buy up lots of different T-shirts. I really like it because it's sometimes I know that they're not actually looking at my tits, they're looking at my T-shirt.
Reading.
Yes. So, and that's when I will push them out and say, yes, read it.
Yes.
Yeah. But I love wearing them, especially in Tesco's.
So funny. People doing double takes. So actually it's quite... So the language around, because obviously people who sell sex and all the different varieties often use quite different words. Mm-hmm. And I think for some people, I think I've got friends, so who like myself have no experience of selling sex, who they know that we use the word sex worker now, but they don't maybe know why or what's wrong with the word prostitute.
Mm-hmm. And some people
call
them...
Yes,
yeah. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's just the problem that it has in regards to the negative stigma surrounded the word.
Yeah.
So rather than just having that one connotation of what that word means, if we can generalise the subject matter, then more people come on board to help promote the idea that sex worker, with the title work, sex workers work.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that... as Charlotte says, it's what the word prostitute became.
Mm.
I've got no problem with the word per se, but the problem with when you say that you're a sex worker, and especially if you come across as kind of, reasonably like middle class, white, it's affluent,
yes,
articulate, confident,
yes,
then people assume that when you're saying that, you mean that you're maybe like a cam girl, or on the more acceptable end of it. And that's something that I wanted to pick up from the book, actually, because you mentioned in the book somebody describing themselves as a dominatrix, and that's something which in the business is very much seen as the more acceptable way of describing yourself.
It's interesting, isn't it? So even within a huge spectrum, sometimes there are narratives which people outside go, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. It's like when someone goes, I understand the narrative of a desperate person who needs drugs. Mm-hmm. I understand this and the tragedy of this, but what I don't understand, or I've noticed that with stripping and things, people like the idea of someone studying, someone in education, paying for education.
Big time,
it's like, this is what she's doing now to empower her later career, because it couldn't just be, this is what she has chosen to do in a work market.
And I think with my work persona, I very much got clients who wanted to pat themselves on the back that they were seeing somebody who was empowered because I wrote about, you know, my academic work and stuff.
Yes.
And that, that we talk about Guardian Reader type articles.
Yes.
But going back to the dominatrix thing, you know, there's this kind of myth that dominatrices, it's not sex work. They don't do sex because they will sort of that there's like a no intercourse rule. Oh. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you're in a private session where somebody ends in climax, however that's manipulated, it's still sex work.
Yes.
So, you know, when you say that you're a sex worker, sometimes people want to, as you say, pigeonhole that into more acceptable ways. And so I would just say, you know, sex worker as in escorting, you know, prostitution, if you want to call it that, but we prefer.
Because that's another thing that's an interesting... So when someone says escort, there's a real... Again, it's a different kind of snobbery, actually, where... I feel like people legitimise people who are paid a lot more money. Because again, I guess that's where the privilege comes in. Is it must be a choice. If this person's paid hundreds of pounds per hour, they can pick and choose clients. They can pick and choose what they're doing there. And then at the other end, so when people are being paid in, like in tens, it's quite often used against women. I was reading, you know, I'm reading Revolting Prostitutes at the moment, and so it's come up a lot for me. But there's a Scottish MP saying, well, these women are only getting paid £37 for full intercourse. So if we criminalise them, we're not even taking that much money away from them.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Like,
fine.
It's actually like the worst argument in the world.
Yeah.
The idea that it's a small amount of money to a woman earning 70 grand a year means that they can't be surviving off this other than,
I think that gives you the sense of where survival sex comes in, really.
Yes, yeah.
There's two ends, massively. The very two-dimensional view of tragic or glamorous, and there's no real in-between. And I think that the society's understanding of acceptance when it comes to sex work is either a pity, or a, type thing.
Yeah.
And I think that whether the values of financial transactions will always be different no matter where you go, it comes down to the reasons why.
Yeah.
You know, you've got people that are doing it just to make sure that they can fund a roof over their head, and then you've got people that want to make a professional business out of it. I mean, I don't think it really matters in the choice of clients that you see. I mean, for me, I work a lot with people with disabilities, and I get that. Oh, she works with people with disabilities. Oh, well, that's okay.
That's okay.
Then.
Well, actually, I thought that. I was reading an article about you, and I was and actually, that was the thing that it was stressing was. Because again, I think it really legitimizes, like, there, if we see sex as this. A kind of basic human need, not saying human right, but human need, then how amazing that for someone who might not have access to that contact, a sex worker is willing to sell it to them.
Yeah. And I think that your mum's right, we should have NHS vouchers
for
that. Yeah. But then it comes down to, well, who's entitled to that?
I'm interrupting the podcast just to clarify. Charlotte's saying my mum's opinion there is something I wrote about in my book. My mum once mentioned that she thought that the NHS should provide sex workers for people because sex is a human right.
You know, and this is the difference. I mean, I've got a client that had to wait 18 months before he got the all clear through family solicitors and doctors, just before he was allowed to be able to see somebody. And I think that's really, really wrong. That you're.
Oh, so he had to ask permission.
He can't speak. He communicates with his eyes. So you know, he's quadriplegic, and he's wired up to many different machines for breathing, and all sorts of things. And because of the medical condition, they have to go through all the paperwork and, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's.
I didn't know there was paperwork.
Oh yeah.
So this is incredible. So so this man communicated with his eyes to somebody.
Yep, to his parents.
His parents.
Yep.
I want to have sex.
Yep.
Yep.
Pretty much. And 18 months before they got the all clear because of medication, the machines that he's on. So
it wouldn't be at risk to his life.
Exactly.
And in terms of, so his parents, they wouldn't get in trouble for that?
No. This is the thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, but for that, for somebody who's listening to this would hear that and go, well, oh, yeah, she's doing a great thing.
Yeah.
But then when somebody walks through my door who's able-bodied, who may be in a perfectly loving relationship at home but not getting any sex, that's kind of frowned upon.
Yeah, or even they get sex, but they also want to
They want more sex.
Yeah. Or easier than meeting somebody in a bar. Or sometimes people are aroused by the transaction.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that... As you obviously say many times in the book, it's about power, and that was my experience. You know, I mean, overall, I just have my main takeaway from life is men are awful. Awful.
Yeah.
Men are awful.
I think men are wonderful.
I think
they're great. I really do think they're great.
I think that as a on a one-to-one level, you can connect with men and they have wonderful elements, but I think as a species, men, for me, are past help, and I don't have any hope. Yeah. And I think that your sort of perspective right in the book, what my reading of it is that you're quite sad about what you found, especially like with pornography and what it shows you.
Do you know what? I was actually much sadder before I started writing the book.
Right.
So I think I started from a position very like what you're saying in terms of individually, I find lots of men to be wonderful, but I think I had a real sexism, which was, but underlying it all is this awful, there's this awful kind of, I guess what I thought is men can be civilized out of something, but there's something essentially underneath them, which you can't trust them and wouldn't actually want to be alone with lots of them. So I think researching the book made me feel better because I'd been so scared. I'm such a naive person, and I was definitely very naive in my feminism, which I think lots of well-meaning people can be.
I was very much at the same point you were. Mm. You know, when I didn't want sex work to exist when I was a young feminist because I didn't want to live in a world where men looked at women that way, and I didn't want, you know, there to be a... an industry where it's primarily women who were, you know, it's sort of...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there are women who are anti things like stripping or page three, or because they think that if that exists, then men have permission to look at all women that way. And that's, again, where we have a binary, which there is no middle ground. It's saying that someone might look at a page three girl and still have female employees that they treat very fairly. It isn't kind of allowing for that. But that's really interesting, your journey. So... how old were you when you had kind of that kind of opinion?
So I started actually looking into sex work for my sort of sociology degree. And I was very anti. I was very much in the Kat Banyard sort of camp.
Yes. Kat Banyard is a British author and an activist against sexual inequality. She's written two books, The Equality Illusion and Pimp State, Sex, Money and the Future of Equality.
And I did my dissertation about sex workers. And basically, I spoke to sex workers and I thought, you're completely wrong here. You know, you're going to have to basically revise your worldview.
Oh, so when you spoke to the sex workers, you then realised you were wrong, not them.
No, I realised I was totally wrong. Yeah. I was like, I've been making these crass generalisations. Mm. You know, I was pretty disgusted with myself.
It's very
basically.
Common because you have a tiny narrative that you've been fed, which is that there's something... really not sacred, but that sexual behaviour isn't something that you can sell without damage to yourself or to damage to the extended world.
I mean, I think that I've never really been at that point. I mean, to me, sex has always been, I'm very like a handshake, right?
Yeah.
I've never attached emotional sort of feelings and stuff to sex with partners or whatever. I mean, it's been part of a relationship, but so for me, coming into sex work was not difficult. And I think that some of the wrangles that you seem to have in the book is because you're thinking, God, I would find that really difficult doing that.
Yeah, the subjectivity. I think that's the thing. Again, sometimes people's difficulty in understanding any other human's point of view. There are some people who would never have an abortion, who just wouldn't, who just wouldn't. Mm. And they can't, and some of those people are men, unfortunately, making laws, but they can't get into the headspace of somebody who would want to.
Yeah.
And I think that could also be the same with... But I'm very interested in this jump. So you were interviewing sex workers, and at what point did you then think... oh, I'm going to do it.
So then I went through a period of sort of a lot of change in my life. So a lot of kind of people died and things like that.
Yeah.
And I thought that just over a period of a few years, my personal circumstances changed a lot. I didn't have any money. And I thought, I am a pragmatic person.
Yeah.
I've got skills. I've got marketing skills. I mean, 95% of sex work, I don't know what your view is, admin, but, you know, marketing.
Yeah.
And so you've got to have those skills to run a business, website, SEO, all these sorts of boring things. And I thought I wouldn't have any problem with the transaction itself.
Yes.
So I thought, I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of my feminism, actually... sex work was the thing that has helped me more than anything else in my life because it's made me realise how transactional all our male-female relationships are.
Yeah.
And it put me in a position of power whereby in the past, when men used to look at you on the tube and dressing you with their eyes, you used to feel kind of, oh, that's horrible, you know. And then once I started working as a sex worker and I was actually charging men for emotional labour and to see me physically and all these sorts of things, it made me, when he was undressing me with my eyes on the tube, I'd think, well, you couldn't afford me, mate. And I've got a, you know, I've got a rucksack full of cash from the people who were prepared to pay me. So it, for me, it changed the footing.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I wanted to go back to the admin thing because I was reading an article. It was in The Sun. And so it's, so you must have tweeted it, Charlotte. And it, and your daughter was saying how proud she is of your work and how much admin there is that people don't realise.
I mean, there's masses amount. The minute you get up, you switch your phone on, you've got emails, you've got text messages. Now there's so many different social media platforms. There's many different ways to communicate.
Aren't you?
Oh, gosh, yes. You've got the directories that you advertise your work on. Then you've got your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. They're all there, you know. And by the time, so if you're getting up at 8 o'clock, you're not finished admin till at least half 11, 12 o'clock. And then you're looking at where you're going to advertise, what dates, booking hotels, booking venues, you know, how you're going to get there. It's, people think that, you know, you're just laying on your back with your legs in the air, and it's not about
tiny,
that whatsoever.
It's really
not.
Percentage of your working day. And then there's the issue that because of a lot of the legalisation, stigmatisation, all these sorts of things, bookings are unreliable. So no matter how hard you try to sort of take deposits or, you know, go into a dialogue with your clients to make sure they're going to attend, you can still finish up. You know, I've started the week with a decent amount of work booked in and in the preceding couple of days, perhaps it's the end of the pay month, you know, all those clients will suddenly decide that they're not quite as horny.
Oh, really?
And so then you've got an empty diary to fill. And so then you're looking at sort of using different forms of media to get work, you know, advertising places that you can get bookings on the day. But at the end of the day, you've got your rent to pay for where you're working
and
from.
So, and, and that is directly related for you in terms of the legalisation or the, so some people are worried. You think?
A lot of it, sex work is already partially decriminalised here in the UK anyway. I think the working methods that you've just described really just depend. I think it depends on people's working ethics, on how they've been able to construct themselves to be able to develop client base. But, I mean, everybody's work ethics are very, very different. I can't remember what the point I was
I was just asking you about the admin. And in terms of the reasons, so you could fill your diary up so you know, I've got all of these things, if my rent's this much and I know that I'm earning this much, so I've covered myself. But if two of those clients cancel or don't turn up suddenly...
I think what I would say is that, I mean, I've known people working from different levels of privilege who work in different ways. And I'd say that we all share in common the fact that clients can be quite flaky. And I think that that is to do with, when I say sort of legalisation, stigmatisation, I think that that comes down to the fact that clients don't really value your work in the same way that they would value an accountant.
So it's not that they're scared that there's going to be a sting or that you're undercover cop.
No, I don't. No, occasionally, maybe. But
it's much more,
as a rule, it's,
they don't
it's
respect
you're
your
disposable.
Time.
In terms of, in a way that, you know, a 250 quid appointment with an accountant or a dentist would not be, you wouldn't just cancel, no notice.
But also, if you cancel a massage on the day, you have to pay for the massage. They take your card details.
And it is, you are left in a position of saying, I mean, people will charge rebooking cancellation fees, but then, you know, clients sometimes won't come back to you. So it's very difficult in terms of that, for me anyway.
What I thought was interesting about your daughter talking to the press is that people, one of the things, again, I think people who have nothing to do with the industry, they're always either surprised or expect other people to be surprised that people's family are supportive, that people are open about their work. They're very, there's this odd fascination with partners. So, and is your boyfriend okay with that? Or is your husband proud of you? And I think that's why you are seem to be a kind of unicorn figure because,
I think... I mean, Colin and I, we've been together for 3 years, and when I did the BBC Three, Things Not to Say to a Sex Worker, the amount of comments that came on there about that, oh, he must be a pimp, he's pimping her out, he's living off her wages, because I do earn more than my partner. But so we were quite lucky enough that we were able to speak to another media company and say, look, can we get this, put a story straight? And I think that it's... people's misunderstanding of what's going on, they automatically generalise of the historical stigmatisation that surrounds sex work.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, anybody that's of a partner, whether it be male or female, will be seen as that role as, oh, OK, well, she's obviously got no choice in the matter. They're doing it for somebody else or for something else.
Yeah.
With my daughter, I mean, my family have been absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I can remember when I told my dad, and he said to me, now, will it stop my tomatoes in my garden from growing next year? And I said, no. And he said, well, don't worry about it then. Yeah. I was like, right, OK.
Yeah, priorities. Perfect. Tomatoes, fine. It. Yeah.
My mum, she was supportive. My sister was supportive. A couple of my nieces and nephews, they were a little bit unsure. But as they've asked questions and they've read more about the open discussions, they've come to terms with what I do. And I don't, it's not as though I go out to the world, right, this is who I am, you must accept me. You know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. All I can do, and with the media work that I do, currently still doing, is to open up that discussion of, okay, this may be your moral opinion of why you don't like it, but rather than looking at that, let's look at the actual underlining factors, that it's a labour activity that we're doing, and we need to incorporate the same working rights as any other industry.
Yeah. So that's been the biggest thing I have learned in the last few months, is that even people who think they have moral reasons or want to protect people or vulnerable people, the labour rights thing doesn't.
No,
is still part of
and
that
I'm
discussion.
I'm very hot on health and safety at work.
Yeah,
I mean, in all my previous work, I've been like the fire safety rep and all these things.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I'm looking at this, as you say, semi sort of decriminalised activity, and thinking, why the fuck don't sex workers have the rights?
Yes.
And one sort of thing that I often think about, sort of analogy that I often use, is, do you remember when the cockle pickers at Morecambe Bay?
Yes.
Yeah. So that was a tragedy that affected vulnerable people. Mm. And the response of the government wasn't to say people shouldn't eat cockles, right? It was to say, let's regulate, let's make these it so that these people can still work, but in safer conditions, whether or not that worked or not, or not is a separate issue. But, and I think that people don't look at sex workers and think, how can we protect them? You know, how can we enable this?
How can we make them safer?
I mean, this is the other side of that scenario, is that when we try and break down the understandings of legalization, decriminalization, and criminalization, is when people think, well, you've got one side that says, we want regulations in, so that the legalisation of it. You've got the other side that wants it criminalised because they think that that protects the workers, despite the fact that Northern Ireland is a perfect example of why it's not working.
Yeah.
And then people automatically think, OK, well, if it's decriminalised, that means the pimps can do this, they can do this, they do this, because nobody's feeding them the correct information.
Yes.
One of the things that you'll find is that no matter how many times you get English Collective of Prostitutes, Swarm, all these various different organisations, Beyond the Gays, a National Ugly Mugs, doing all these papers and reports on the actual statistics, they get buried away and never get distributed. I mean, two years ago, they did an evidence symposium at Parliament to state why. They had 50 different countries around the world come in and say why we need it, and it never gets referred back to when it comes to it.
Yeah.
But we have to be, we as sex workers, past sex workers, we need to be very careful when we communicate the word regulation, because that's when, okay, so do we have the legalisation structure that we do in Amsterdam, where it's the council government that's regulating sex work?
Yeah.
Problem with that, you've got to then pay a very expensive licence.
Yes.
Your name then gets put on a database, and it's exactly the same of what would happen if you were soliciting in the UK, is the minute that you get caught, that's on your criminal record. And if anybody wants to do further education in the future to then better themselves, they've got no chance of getting a job.
I mean, just to be clear, I'm not advocating regulation. I'm just advocating the fact that people should care about working conditions and rights.
I mean, being a single sex worker on their own, we've got those rights. But if we want to work away in different areas to be able to better ourselves financially and have somebody with us for safety, that's where the problem is.
That's interesting, because actually that's something that came up with both of you when I originally talked to you. So, and I had no idea. So the laws in this country prohibit a sex worker working alongside somebody else in the same
building.
There's lots of reasons you might do that. One might just be company, but the other one is a safety issue.
Yeah.
And that is counted as running a brothel.
That's right.
And that is illegal.
That is illegal. So, and I mean, you know, obviously, you know, we talk about the safety issue, but one of the main reasons in London that you might do it is for the financial issue.
Trying to rent
a flat in central London
on
your own and pay for that for all the time, not by the hour, but all the time is ridiculous.
Yes.
It would make much more sense for two or three workers to share that those premises, and even if they're not all there simultaneously, but all have keys and have safety systems where they can, you know, access help and things. And actually, not long after, I think it was around the time that we chatted, a woman working on her own in premises in my area was murdered.
Yeah.
And that had a big impact on me, really, in terms of... Well, just my views about the law and how it is a life and death situation. And as Charlotte points out, there are a lot of people producing the information. It gets to Parliament and there's no political will to get these measures put through Parliament. Mm.
I think it is seen as an unpopular issue. So,
very
for instance, if there was a man, let's say it's Boris Johnson, right? And he... in this scenario, it's a very sensible man who goes, well, this is, it's the law that's actually making people vulnerable. And he sees it that way. Of course, the murderer is a man, but it's the law is made that woman more vulnerable to that man in that situation. This could be preventable. He decides to go out on a limb and say to everybody. and I think he would see it as something that would make him look like he wanted to pay for sex.
Yeah.
And so he would go, and he'd be advised, don't touch that issue.
Mm-hmm.
You can't come out of it. You're not strong enough at this point to go. Mm-hmm. And that's the real shame, is that I guess what you'd want is a kind of single issue politician to be very vocal, like some politicians are about women's rights or, you know, abortion. Like, there are people who would go, oh, no, I'm going to just keep talking about that. Yeah. Mm.
I think sometimes that, I think, because there are a lot of people that are on board who do support decriminalisation.
Yes.
But I actually think that there possibly could be an underlining factor that a lot of MPs don't want it to go through because they like the taboo element of it.
Because obviously lots of politicians do pay for sex.
Yeah, of course they do, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes, my lips are sealed.
Okay. So it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's very interesting with power that so this combination with politicians, you have people who went to public school and so quite often were sent away to boarding school very young, maybe have certain emotional needs as well as sexual fetishes, and who then end up with money and time and the fact that they're either risking something, their respectability when they go and pay for sex. They're obviously, because it does just seem to be more maybe than the general population.
Well, you've got the story with Lord Searle, wasn't it, a few years back? He liked dressing up in ladies' underwear and doing cocaine, and two of the workers secretly filmed him. Mm. I mean, I'm very laid back, I'm very easygoing. As long as you don't harm a third party, do what you want, enjoy yourself. But my concern of that is, number one, that the workers were either paid to be able to do that, which takes away the credibility of any form of sex work in the first place. Mm. If people of power are having that jeopardy of whether or not they're going to be filmed, but it also doesn't give our industry a good light because of the activities that are being seen. You know, if it was a different session where he was getting dressed up as a woman but there was no drugs involved, would people be more accepting of it?
I think it was more wholesome. I guess there are people who want drugs legalised, so maybe if that politician was someone who talked all the time about kind of decriminalising sex work and taxing the drugs industry and helping people with addictions, you'd go, oh, hang on, he practices what he preaches.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there is nothing wrong with dressing up in women's underwear or having kinks and all of that kind of thing. Because actually that's the other thing, isn't it? There's so much sex positivity around transactional sex, in terms of some people have things that, because of shame and stigma, they can't practice in their everyday life or tell a partner. And that's actually incredibly sad.
Yeah.
And I think, you know... when we chatted, you were a little bit disbelieving that I said that I enjoyed sex in some of the transactions that I've had.
Yeah.
And I think that I probably wanted to clarify, one of the reasons that I enjoyed it so much is that when you see a sex worker, you just have a much better negotiation about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
it's time limited, right? Yeah. So, you know, when you're shagging your boyfriend, sometimes you're tired, you don't want it to go on for hours.
Absolutely.
And that affects your enjoyment.
I think that's what swayed. So my experience of sex I haven't enjoyed has been exactly that.
Yeah.
The thing of like, oh God, I shouldn't have started this.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Or I really need a poo or something. Yeah. Right.
And also there can be a real element of performativeness, even with sex with a partner that
of
you
course.
Fancy or love.
Yes.
An element of, well, this is going to get you off. It's not going to get me off. I'm literally doing it for you.
Big time. And then when you see somebody, the way that I used to arrange my sessions was we used to chat via email. So we had some kind of understanding about what the client wanted, right? And I would set out my boundaries as well.
Mm.
You'd never normally do that. You would never normally say, I am not okay with X, Y, Z.
Yes.
I don't like it when you touch there.
Yeah.
If I say this, then it means no. Normally, that's never happened to me in a long and varied sexual career.
People find all of that very off-putting. The thing with dating is all this pretense, like all the will we, won't we? And actually, what's ridiculous about that is you'll end up, most people, in bed with someone for the first time not knowing where they don't want you to touch or where they'd love you what they'd love you to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that when I've enjoyed sex often, it's because I feel so free.
Mm.
I don't feel like I will have to have breakfast with them tomorrow and talk about X, Y, Z, you know, and it's not somebody that I've had to see their dirty pants on the floor.
Yeah.
So
well, you might have to see their dirty pants on the floor.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah. I retract that statement.
But it won't be weeks and weeks of seeing the same pair of pants that he hasn't.
I won't have to wash said. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that there are elements of transactional sex that are actually brilliant and that in ordinary sex we really miss out on.
Yes.
We're missing
or we wouldn't
a trick.
Have the chance to explore in our own personal lives.
Mm.
I mean, I've been a cannibal, I've been a vampire, I've been a Russian spy.
And so when
I've
that happens, so when they ask you, is that quite an exciting thing, like creatively?
Yeah, because I mean, sometimes they'll give me a script. You know, they want me to be.
They've written a script.
I used to have a client who delivered one before the session.
Oh, I just got it.
Oh
yeah.
My gosh.
But they'll deliver a script.
Are they well written scripts?
Not always, no.
No.
I mean, sometimes you get to a point where they only get halfway and then they expect you to fill it in.
Oh, so
I
now you've got to improv.
That. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know that I was in the sex workers opera, so improvising was always an easy thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Russian spy, I had a very short black wig and I had time to the chair and interrogate him.
Was your accent really bad?
It was tragic, really tragic. Yeah. I've never been one for very good for doing accents. Mm. I think I started off Russian and then went Spanish and then ended up sounding like I was Indian or something.
Yeah.
It was just terrible. But the fun element of it is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It really is. Because I really it's something that, you know, the flexibility of your work gives you that time that you can think, right, okay, he wants a doctor. Get my doctor's kit out.
Yeah.
Then and look around, what can I use? What can I use as a stethoscope? What can I do for this? And there is lots of fun elements to it. I mean, there's lots of... You can't say that one job is perfect throughout everything that you do.
And I think that's the difficulty in trying to have a discussion that's more open and more positive, especially hoping, there'll be people listening who haven't even thought about this or don't know.
Yeah.
It feels like, even I'm sitting here going... we're emitting because you want to put something in a more positive light.
There was very grim elements about the performative nature of the work that I did.
Yeah.
Because the services that I used to offer were very much rooted in sort of the porn that's very popular at the moment.
Okay.
So I used to do a lot.
So you would know so much then about what porn is popular because people would be very honest to you about what they're watching.
Well, I mean, all I can talk about is the service that I used to offer, which I'll be specific about, was deep throat oral.
Okay.
And not, you know, that it's fairly difficult to do. It's a,
it's a
skill.
Yes.
And that is something that's incredibly popular, and the amount
but probably because people can't get it, men can't get that
exactly because it's kind of sexual acrobatics, right?
Yes.
And you know, it's not something which
did you always able to do it, or did you teach yourself?
I didn't really teach myself. I think this is a horrible conversation. I've never had much of a gag reflex.
Okay.
And so when I realised that it might be popular, I mean, we were talking about marketing earlier.
Yes,
you have to find a USP.
Yeah,
of course.
Not everybody is the youngest, slimmest, prettiest, almost able at marketing, right? Mm. We've all got disadvantages and advantages in the game.
Mm.
And if you can find a USP and it's something that people like, then that's what brings your clients in. And all of a sudden, you know, I realised that half the booking requests I was getting were specifically for this service.
Yes.
And then, you know, a lot of them were also, they wanted what goes with it. So a lot of them wanted you to wear a lot of mascara that runs.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Red lipstick that smears.
Yes. Yeah. So, and...
So just to clarify, because this is grim, it's because they want you to look... They want it to look like it's very difficult, and crying. That's the mascara thing.
I think that it's not necessarily that they want to look at your face and think that you're hating it, like you're being forced to be sort of mouth raped.
Yes.
Right? I think that it's more that they want it to emulate the porn that they're watching.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the porn that they're watching might be emulating somebody hating it. But I mean, the fact is that if in performing that act, it's a lot of your eyes would run.
Yes.
It's not that you're crying.
It's just what happens when something's deep in your throat.
That's
anyway.
Right, yeah. And a lot of saliva is produced. So a lot of drooling and gagging and stuff. And, you know, I'm sure people listening to this would be revolted by that.
Actually, that's... So in the Hot Girls Wanted documentary, which I think is a great documentary, but you might have completely different feelings about it, because for me, that was the first time I ever heard women saying, I would rather do this than work in a shop.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And it was that. It was people who did have choices.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really the fantastic... The first thing is to go to hear women saying, I could work in a mall. It's an American documentary. I could work in a mall and earn this a week, or I could earn that for working 3 hours. And one of the things they were doing was that deep throat. And obviously they didn't show it in the documentary, but they spoke to them beforehand, they spoke to them afterwards. And also they... had them saying, the guy was really nice to me, because he's obviously another porn performer.
Mm-hmm.
We were really reasonable. But then you saw just tiny clips, so without the dick in the mouth, but the eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's so emotive. So for me, not being aroused by it, I have the exact opposite kind of empathy, which is, I don't want, the poor
That's horrible.
Woman.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
It's awful.
Yeah. Going back to the 2D, isn't it?
Yes.
Tragic or glamorous.
Yeah. But well, sometimes that can just be an emotive reaction, which is why it's so important to untangle where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Because we think, oh, I'm my emotion, so it must be right. Mm-hmm. I felt sorry for her, so it's a tragedy rather than, oh, that's just,
Now, I you're a performer, right? So this is, for me, a performative act.
Mm.
I had mates who were doing girlfriend experience escorting, right?
Yeah.
Now, they had to perform to be a very kind of compliant, educate. They had to perform to be a certain person that flattered a man's ego for a long session.
Yeah.
Whereas I preferred, to do shorter sessions that were much more kind of, I don't know, animalistic or whatever, but in this kind of genre.
Well, I guess the act-based is a short act. It's this act is...
I'm the GFE. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I could not do that. I am a shit actor, shit liar. I can't flatter a man's ego. I'd just be... When they tell me anything, I'd be scoffing, you know?
Yeah.
I'd be like, get over yourself, mate.
It's interesting. One of the people I interviewed does Sugar Baby.
Yeah.
And she was saying the more and more honest she was getting, as in she starts off with a persona.
Yeah.
With the daddies. And then the more and more honest she was being, the closer to herself the persona was, she said, the less I was getting on, the less they wanted to see me again.
Of course.
They hated her feminism.
Oh, of
they
course.
They hated being kind of, and I guess with you call it a GFE, a girlfriend experience, your main job is making them feel good about themselves and saying, you're wrong about that, mate. Or I completely disagree. Or have you read this?
Yeah.
It's confronting sometimes.
Quite.
Whereas for someone else, that might be great.
Yeah.
I think it's strange. I think my persona of who I am has always kind of been there. The only time that I do any acting skills is within my role play scenarios.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People
yeah.
take me for who I am, and if they don't like me, I mean, my retention rate for returning clients is quite high.
Yes.
But then I am slightly rough around the edges, but what you see is what you get.
You've got authenticity.
Certain
clients like that.
I think I had a man pay me for 2 hours to try and convince me that I was abused as a child.
Mm. And he found that arousing, or he thought
that I was abused as a child. And then the 2 hours was up, and he said, I'm going to have to go, but I'd love to come back and see you later this evening. And I thought, okay, well, give me a call. And I didn't respond back to it, but, you know.
So when he said that, you think, so just to clarify for me, so he just wanted to talk to you. So it wasn't a sexual session.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he couldn't believe anyone would do your job without having had a history
of
abuse.
Sure, you can, you've had it where, oh, you're too pretty for this. Or, oh, you've got a brain on your shoulders. Oh, no, I don't understand why you're doing this.
Yes, yeah.
You know, it's... I mean, for me, I gave up teaching to do what I do.
Yes.
And the biggest reasons for me was, one, the teaching had just overtaken my life. I was getting up at stupid o'clock in the morning, finishing stupid o'clock in the evening. I was hardly seeing my children. I had no social life whatsoever. I'm a horny girl. And I went out. I finally went out and I saw a guy out. And we went back to home. We ended up having sex. And he came and then he got up and started getting dressed. I said, well, where are you going? He says, well, I'm done. And I thought, you know what? This is just absolutely sickening. And and that moment was probably the lowest moment I've ever felt shame over sex.
Yes.
The fact that is perfectly acceptable for me to pick somebody up in a club and come home and have sex. But for me to go out to work and get paid to have sex, somebody's moral opinion is shunned upon me as a fallen, broken woman. And I just think that that's where society's gone wrong. Because if you're so concerned in the sense of what I'm doing, what's going on in your own life that you should be looking at?
Yeah.
All we should be doing as a society, as humanity, is ensuring that everybody is safe and everybody's well-being is looked after. For those who come into the industry who don't want to be in the industry, we need to be looking at ways of how to be able to exit strategies to get them out safely and financially stable.
Also,
the people who want to be in leave us to it.
But also, it's the thing about that level of society. It's a much bigger thing, which is, I think, why people who are, say, or they want to provide exit strategies, it's so hard to look at. There's a level of poverty which actually needs to be dealt with regardless of gender.
Big time. Get rid of poverty and you get rid of people who are unwillingly in the sex industry.
Absolutely.
It was on TV only yesterday, wasn't it, that looking at survival, sex and poverty.
Yes.
I mean, people who are trying to apply for universal credits, it takes 5 weeks before any money comes through.
Yes.
And what can they do financially to be able to secure themselves within that 5 weeks?
Yeah.
So this is why the biggest percentage of sex workers are single mothers. And you know, it's really challenging, but hopefully they're going to be looking at that they get an instant payment there and then.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. I'm looking.
But even
up, so, hopefully.
we've got a benefit system that
doesn't
ensures
work.
People are in poverty.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's not enough money. You know.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I think that a lot of sex workers, certainly that I met when I was sort of before I was in the industry, were just kind of real grafters who just said, "This gives me and my family a better life."
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and they're just hardworking women who want to do something a bit better for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, as a single mum, I spent 4 years doing my degree with my children aged 3 and 4.
Mm.
And then after 4 years of that, I went into teaching. And the time, I was just missing out on my children growing up.
Mm.
And the fact that within that month's money of me teaching and finishing my PGCE, within 3 jobs, I'd covered my month's money.
Yes.
And then it just, you know, number one...
And so how did that feel?
Well, that everything financially was secure was brilliant, but it's so strange that my first ever job when I joined an agency in Devon was it was a middle-aged man and he had a business suit on and he invited me and he offered me a drink and he was more concerned about my orgasm than his own.
Really?
And you know, I've never been shy at that. I was always quite promiscuous when I was younger anyway.
Yeah.
So to do something that I enjoy and get paid for it was just a bonus. Mm-hmm. But as the years have progressed... I think people because men are wonderful, women are wonderful. I mean, I've a lot of my clients are women as well.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And I've paid for sex myself, so I've been on the receiver and the giver. And it's, you know, you get men that are arseholes, you get women that are arseholes, and I just think that people are wonderful. And I think rather than judging them for the actions that you may not agree to, just appreciate each other for who we are and what we can do for each other on that level. And I think that. I go into my preaching element of life is wonderful.
Yeah.
Everything is awesome.
Yes. Yeah. And so I'm really interested in the female clients.
Yes.
Because when we talk about sex work, I fall in, lots of people fall into a trap of going, all of the people selling sex are female and all the people buying it are male. So I'm really fascinated.
I mean, my female clients, They've been lovely. They've been really lovely.
And so do you think it's something that's becoming more common?
Yeah. I mean, for me purchasing sex from a man, I was lonely. I had, I was living in Devon, working in London. Mm. I was here for 3 nights and I was working myself. So it wasn't as though the activity was something that I wasn't getting any of.
Yes.
But I just wanted a male company for myself. And do you know, when the tables are turned, my first time, I was incredibly shy. Yeah, I was really shy. Yeah, and I'll offer you a free massage. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Like that. But, you know.
So it was a man you hadn't met before.
I hadn't met him. No. And it's, I think that, I mean, if you've probably seen male profiles online, that when you've looked at them, you've got guys that think they could become sex workers and show a picture of their cock.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is what they do. They go, I think I could sell this.
Yes, but they do it so unprofessionally. They just take a shot of their torso downwards.
And, an awful webcam picture.
Yeah, it's dreadful. Like, or you get a professional wearing a really nice suit or, you know, looking nice. He's taking time for the photos and they've got a proper bio, you know, something, I would like to do this, I'd like to do this, rather than, I could fuck for England.
Yeah.
It's just, but that's kind of what appealed to me. And, I hired him for two hours. He stayed an extra half an hour. And the first time we didn't actually have sex. We chatted for a little bit. He did give me a massage and then we went to the pub for a pint.
Yeah.
And it kind of gave me that more of a, okay, this is interesting to do it on this side of the fence.
Did it make you see, it's so interesting to kind of have your job reversed to kind of think, okay, so now I can understand what someone who's paying for me to come and visit them might feel just before I walk through the door or...
No, not really. It's really difficult to explain because as workers, we know what our kind of strategic planning is. We open the door, we invite them in. Would you like a drink? Sit them down. Yeah. How are you? Pleasantries. Take the money. Do's and don'ts. Get in the shower. You know, we've got that flow.
Yeah.
When it's the other way around, I don't think men have that strategic forward planning as what we do when it's a service. They'll come in and they kind of make themselves all floaty and alert, trying to alert you to them, which is very, very different, isn't it? I think that when women are offering, we have this strategic plan that we know our time lengths of how to be able to get through these various activities within this time to make sure that it ends happily.
Because what would happen if someone's paid for an hour and they haven't orgasmed?
It doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter what activities you do. It's the time that you're paying for.
So you just go, okay, that's our hour.
Well, no, I mean, I've gone over. Okay. If you're in the midst of things,
Yeah, it depends. I mean, if they're clearly, you know, if they're a nice client and they're clearly about to come, then you might be flexible.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as you get more professional and practice, you work out a way of, if you realise they're not getting anywhere near at 1:45, I mean, what I always used to say is, our time together will be coming to an end soon, you know, in a nice way, just to basically put on, God, you're going to have to be dressed and out the door fairly soon, mate.
Yes.
You know?
So,
or it's one of them.
Finger up the bum.
Does that really work?
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Squeeze everyone
just
up.
Just depends on the position you get in as well.
Yeah.
A lot of men like it, and it's often something that I think men feel embarrassed about asking for.
They do, absolutely.
Yeah, I think, and in terms of all of the different levels of stigma and shame that we're all kind of taught, there is something about men and their bum holes where they absolutely know that they have a prostate gland and it's pleasurable, but I think there's so much kind of imbibed homophobia with straight men that anything to do with the bum is
and that's the first thing they normally say
I'd like to try it, but isn't that awful
yeah.
I mean, in terms of, I know obviously my concentration is always this kind of the messages towards women, but men are getting the exact same amount and this whole that certain things make their sexuality questionable, or there's anything wrong with having a questionable sexuality. It's so awful.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I've always get this. So in my pleasantries, I'll say, is there anything that you particular that you'd like to try today? And he said, oh, well, just everything. I'll go, oh, brilliant, I've got a strap on over there. I'll go get it. Oh, no, not that.
Yes.
But I mean, when you get an array of toys, oh, what toys do you have? Oh, what would you like? Toys for me, toys for you? Oh, both. And then you get all these big random things. They're like, okay, and they try and like scoot the men ones away just to look at yours. There is a huge thing, isn't there, in regards to a man's bumhole.
It's
funny, especially even when you're going down, you're in that area and you're playing that way, and if you stroke your finger too far underneath the balls, they'll kind of, you can see their
attention,
please don't go there, it's like that sort of thing.
So the job must be quite intuitive when you're kind of, especially if you're very experienced mm-hmm. at your job, in terms of knowing, oh, when someone reacts like that, they're uncomfortable, and this person's mm-hmm. reacting, going, oh, yes, please.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, you get very good at going, okay, like playing an instrument.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it is. You read in a lot of physical signs, and it becomes, it does become quite intuitive. And then, of course, you get a client that's completely different, and all of a sudden you're kind of learning
all over again.
Yeah, your vibe is thrown, and you're all sort of, so sometimes it doesn't go as smoothly, but I think when you're seeing clients regularly, and when you fall into a niche of what you're offering, you know, so at times I did a lot of BDSM, and sometimes I did sort of what they call sensual domination, and a lot of that is men exploring their anal fantasies.
Is it?
Yeah, and you get very sort of used to how that session might go in terms of, okay, at this point I'll tie you up, at this point we'll do some to play with toys, at this point. And if you think about that, again, it's a lot of stuff
that
is often,
has to go into it as well.
But it's a lot of stuff that's missing from a lot of ordinary couples' sex lives, isn't it?
But this is it. Yeah. This is where it comes down to poor education as we're nurtured when it comes to sex. I mean, at school, we're only ever taught about the reproductive system and procreation.
Yes.
We're never even, we don't really discover what pleasure is, or, I mean, especially as females with straight sex, when you're, you know, you probably didn't even orgasm when you first lost your virginity.
No one talks to girls about the importance of that.
No.
Yeah.
Nobody teaches men how to, you know, women learn to wank on bananas and things, you know. Nobody teaches men how to stimulate women.
Yes.
In most of my relationships, men haven't seen it as a priority for me to have an orgasm.
No. It's strange because actually, so even without pornography, especially without pornography, because pornography does obviously know the clitoris exists and shows acts that concentrate on it. But if you look at all of like mainstream media, all you see is sex where people come from penetration, and that's what people see, and it's like every time you should kick the TV over and go like, she wouldn't come like that.
They've said that it's about 33% of women can only do that, but that's only in a case when the clitoris is being stimulated grinding or rubbing anyway. And you know, it's but this is the thing, is that the acts that they do see in porn, people will mimic because that's what they expect to see in real life. You know, as a sex worker, I try and come away from the PSE, which is the porn star experience,
So that's the thing that people so porn star experience is when someone will have seen something online or a few times and gone, that's my thing.
When I do my do's and don'ts, I'll say I really enjoy kissing. I don't like my hair being pulled. I don't like my ears being nibbled. And they'll say, ears being nibbled. I say, I lose earrings that way and I never get them back. And, you know, it's that they don't do that. It's that horrible...
Oh, yeah, no, it's disgusting.
Sound in my ear,
I
can't stand it.
Yeah. And also it's slobbery.
It
like,
is,
it's
yeah.
spit in your ear.
But it's the pulling of the hair. So, you know, and...
And that's something that you think they might find sexy because they've seen it in porn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, or they think very much part of that trope. And also squirting, that's something that had never happened to me until a client made me squirt. And I was like, I didn't know a woman's body could do that.
Yes.
Where was that in my sex education?
Yes, that there's a possibility that happens to some people.
And I mean, that's something that you see in porn, and that a lot of people think in porn it's faked.
Yes.
And it wasn't until I had an experience where I was basically like lost 3 litres of fluid from my body that I thought, God,
well, I knew someone, I don't actually know her anymore, so she squirted, and actually she had huge shame about it because so it's something she had to explain to her partners because they thought she was wetting the bed.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. I actually, because I was on top, and the first time I actually thought that he pissed up me because I just did not know what
Where
was happening.
Where the hell did it come from?
Why are we soaking wet?
And so did the orgasm feel different?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Well, when I squirt, I don't have an orgasm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I'm sorry my clients who are listening to this that thought I did.
It's weird.
I didn't feel anything. I just...
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was quite fun. It was like, oh, my God, what's happening?
Yes.
But it wasn't like an orgasmic feeling.
Yeah,
it's very different for me. So when I orgasm, I kind of clench and tense and, you know, it heightens it up around the body. Mm. Whereas when I'm squirting, everything has to be really relaxed.
Yes.
So when I come from tensing, once I've come, that's it. don't go there.
Yes.
Leave me alone.
So
let me rest.
Yeah.
But when I do that, it's kind of like if I'm on a scale of 1 to 10 and my tensing orgasm is 10, my squirting orgasm will be 9 that I can hold for ages and I'll never quite reach 10.
Ah,
but you just
okay.
keep going. So
but it kind of floats around there for a much longer time.
So I don't get that type feeling. I get that type feeling.
Okay.
And that's probably the only way I can
but it's really interesting.
It. Yeah.
So obviously, like, your job has kind of pushed your body to experience all of these kind of things.
Yes.
That, I mean, I know some people probably do have very exciting sex lives who, when sex isn't their job as well, but it is a thing that you have to kind of stay very open to if you want to explore it or to know that out of curiosity, it's something that you can explore.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people like Charlotte mentioned think that sex work is just lying on your back with your legs open.
Mm.
I think as you become more skilled, you realise actually that there's a large repertoire to the sexual experience.
Yes.
And that obviously clients come to see you for stuff that is they may not get in there.
Yes.
I think as we also said earlier, there a lot to me was about power.
Yes.
In the sexual transaction.
Mm.
But in terms of the activities, it is a series of things that you have to become quite skilled at, and they're quite specialist services.
Yes, it is specialist services. Mm.
But what I do is I help a lot of people learn skills so they can go out and better themselves in the future.
So essentially giving them sexual confidence and sexual know-how so that they absolutely know what pleases them and how to please somebody else. Yeah.
I mean, I still classify it as sex work, but it's more sexual surrogacy in what I do. And without the skills and knowledge and experience that I've gathered from my journey in sex work, I would have never been able to do that. And I started that doing this in 2013. And surprisingly enough, my dad and I sat down together and I said, look, this is what I want to do. These are the courses that I want to put together. And he sat down and helped me put this whole business together.
Yes, yeah.
And so I offer sexual training to a lot of different people. But this is the thing, is that people are more, would be more accepting to the point of, okay, if they're teaching people skills to better themselves in the future, then that's okay. But we're still doing that.
Yes.
Whether somebody hires me as a sexual trainer or hires me as a prostitute, we're still doing that.
Yes.
You know, and people just don't get that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have more people walk through, but and this is probably different from many other people.
Yeah.
I have more people walk through my door wanting me to teach them how to perform oral sex on a female and kissing. Those are the main two areas that I really deliver because they've just got no idea.
Yeah.
But as a sex worker, as a prostitute, as an escort, people would look at me and go, well, all she's doing is taking money to be fucked by them. And
you're absolutely right about it. It's just either ignorance or naivety, but a preconceived idea that isn't actually getting, for lots of people, questioned because they don't hear from sex workers.
Because
you're absolutely right. If people see it as a form of therapy.
Well, they can't hear from sex workers because people are going, oh, she claims that she likes it, or she's only doing it for this reason. Oh, she's addicted to drugs, or somebody pays you for 2 hours and tries to convince you you've been abused. You know, it all comes down to choice. And it's, if anybody brings up prostitution with the word trafficking or coercion in mixed in with it, you've got it completely wrong and you need to be re-educated.
Yes.
Because prostitution is completely separate from trafficking and coercion.
Yeah.
When it comes down to prostitution, it's down to choice.
Mm.
You either have to through survival, sex and poverty, or you want to because you want to establish a business that's profitable in the long term.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah, and for some people it's supplementing another job. There are lots of people who they do have jobs, but occasionally to make extra money.
Yeah.
And so rather than having all of the admin and rota of clients, they might have one or two or three people that they sleep with occasionally that it's understood that it's for cash and things like that.
I mean, my job's not amazing. It's not all flowers and roses. Some days I have good days, some days I have bad days, some days I have terrible days.
Yeah.
But it's work.
Well,
just
that's the
like
same,
any other job.
Well, that's the same with my job.
Yeah.
But because my job has no stigma, I never have to just say the positives. No, I love it. It's my choice.
It's
great. No, never had a bad gig ever. Like, they're all just joy and I come.
Yeah.
I come every time. Every time I do a gig.
Yeah.
It's genuine pleasure for me. I'm lucky. Yeah. I'm just built that way.
I mean, I have clients that I get into such awkward positions that because I've had two children and I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. I've got a small area between my L4 and 5 on my back that rubs away on my vertebra.
Ooh,
so when I get myself into certain positions, done it where I've literally I've got into this space in this tiny bed, and then I've got 20 minutes before I am no longer going to be able to walk.
Mm.
And I'm literally, okay, you're gonna have to do me a favor, come and pick me up because I can't drive. And it's, and I'm walking around and I'm just trying to put I look stupid. I look like a baboon because my bum will go out where my spasm's going down my back.
Oh gosh, you know, and poor thing.
But
then actually this is something that's quite interesting. Some people something we kind of talked about as well, but because the other side of it is there are some people who have got different physical abilities, and that's why sex work is actually much a better option for them.
And I think this is something that I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned in your book a situation, I can't remember exactly what you say, but you basically intimate that once a worker has agreed to enter into a sexual transaction with a client, that there's then no choice or negotiation in that session. You say something like, the man could do what he wants to her, like he could hurt her if he wanted.
Oh, I see.
And I think, like, I suppose I'd like to correct that.
Yes.
I think that, yes, you know, we're vulnerable, and that stigma makes us more vulnerable.
Yes.
And you might get a predator who knows that you're on your own, and that he's more likely to get away with it if he hurts you. Then.
Mm.
But for the vast majority of the time, sessions are much more intensely negotiated than they would be in a straight relationship, because you're re-establishing those boundaries all the time, especially if you've got somebody who is wanting to push boundaries.
Yes.
You know, so... and also, I think that people tend to think that once you've agreed to sell sex, that your humanity's gone. Clients will understand. They'll understand if you've got a dodgy back. They'll understand if it's, I don't know, all of a sudden you're in a position and your elbow...
It's not like you would have to suppress everything because he's enjoying himself or she's enjoying herself. It would be much more a human interaction, like
Most of the vast majority of the time they are just people.
Yeah.
You know, they are just ordinary people, and they recognise that we are just ordinary people.
Yeah.
And in a lot of, I mean, I had quite a good retention rate, and I established some friendships. I'm still in touch with a couple of clients. Mm-hmm. Very, very caring about your welfare and about how you genuinely you are as a person.
Yeah.
Is everything all right with you? How's your house?
Yeah.
You know, are you still studying?
Yeah.
Well, I think this comes down to, I mean, when we spoke earlier about privilege, I think this really, really does come down to that, because you've got to also look at, for us, we managed our business very well and very professional. And I think that that is an element of privilege within sex work. But then you've got to look at places like Leeds and for street workers in their managed areas, they don't have that ability to dictate how the session would go, because it's, you know, it's done quite fast. I think Leeds managed area is a really poor design.
So this is Holbeck.
The Holbeck estate will be discussed in more detail in episode 8.
So basically, people think, oh, well, you've got a red light area that you can work from.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, it's not like that. So you can do the transaction of money, but you can't actually have sex in that area.
You have to go away. Just for anyone listening who doesn't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, so this is the government trialling as one of the... They've listened to sex workers.
The council.
And they've said... let's have an area where it's
that
legal
to do the business,
but not to have the sex.
But not to have the sex.
So what has to happen?
So as soon as they've gone to the red light area to do the financial transaction, the sex worker would then go into the vehicle, and then they'd go somewhere else to have intercourse.
Okay.
So the safety element of it isn't there at all, really.
Yeah.
The point that I was getting at was when you've got, the problem that we have is that the minute that element is still criminalised, people aren't, when they're going to areas that don't have these zones, somebody will have to get into the car quite quickly.
Yes.
They don't know whether somebody's in the back seat. They have to get in that car quickly.
It's such a quick assessment.
Yes, that's so they don't have
danger.
That time to discuss the pros and cons.
And establish the boundaries.
Exactly.
It's vital. And they just, like you say, they've got limited options. The time is tiny.
Yes.
And that could really mean life or death.
And there's always an element of risk taking.
Yeah. Of course.
Even if the majority of people aren't.
Well, you've got risk taking. Any sex worker is at risk, but they are more vulnerable than me being a privileged sex worker.
Yes.
I mean, it was. So can you remember the guy, Ruddick, his name was? He was a banker from Canary Wharf. He killed two prostitutes. Mm. I met him a year and a half prior at Bristol. And he came into my hotel suite. I made him a cup of tea. I offered him a tea or coffee. Yeah. He wanted a tea. And he was pleasant. He was lovely. Mm. He was like a cuddly bear. And, you know, that was a nice experience. Yet a year and a half later, he goes...
So you didn't get any kind of bad behaviour or even dodgy?
No, like that.
It was the ladies in the Philippines.
That's right, yeah. So basically, he was engaged
was
to
really
a woman
upsetting.
Who then cheated on him, broke everything off, and he just had a psychological
rage.
Collapse.
Yeah.
And, you know, he even emailed out his boss that he's going to do something terrible. And I think that, you know, what we perceive as human beings, something... can happen, anything can happen. So, you know...
You're right. We think that someone who does something like that is a monster of a different breed of human rather
they're
than...
not, they're just a person.
But this is it. So when I was reading it and I saw the picture, I was like, oh, my God, I shared intimate time with this man.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think that we can all say, oh, I've never had a bad experience. That one bad experience, it could be... that could happen could be the one that ends
also,
the whole situation.
Actually, this is something I found quite interesting in terms of the narratives, is that for lots of people who are trying to get people to lessen stigma about sex workers and listen to them, can't talk about their negative experiences because people instantly go, well, if that's possible, then surely no one should ever be doing this because...
Yeah, for me, it does make it very difficult.
I didn't want to be where I am in regards to the media presence that I have.
Yeah.
This was not something that I was chasing. I didn't want any of this. I was from Exeter. I had a nightclub there that I wanted a little nest egg for the kids. I still carried on sex work.
Yeah.
And when I had my first bit of media on the club, somebody recognised me in a photo and I got an email sent through to me saying that that if I didn't give them free sex or money, they were going to out me to the public. And I was so absolutely frightened. I was supposed to be doing... I was going to do a documentary for Sex on Wheels, which is what Laura Lee did.
Yes.
Laura Lee was an Irish sex worker and civil rights activist who sadly died at the age of 39 in 2018.
And I pulled away and I did a public statement that I resigned from the business. I got a general manager to come in so that it couldn't affect me.
Yeah.
And I just kept getting email after email after email. And I thought, do you know what? If I'm going to be out as a sex worker, I'm going to do it my way.
You're going to have control of it.
And that's what I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got evicted twice from my home.
Mm.
I had my daughter removed from me because of social services when she was 15 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had all the people that you think are there in society to protect me were actually causing me more harm just because of the job that I do for a living.
Yes. Yes.
And I couldn't get support from the government. I wasn't entitled to this. I wasn't entitled to that.
Yeah.
So I did everything that I could by myself. And it's given me a backlash in certain areas of my community.
Mm.
But I...
That was you surviving.
Against
things.
But I still talk proudly about what I do because it wasn't the job; it was the people.
Exactly.
Coming in, or not coming into the job, but the people using my job as an opportunity to capitalise on vulnerability.
Yes.
And to punish you.
Which is what you're describing.
But for me with the police. When I had an issue that I needed the police help, they were fantastic.
Oh, that's good.
Prior to that, I was put under surveillance. Mm. I had cameras around the bottom flat and my top flat from where I was working because they thought I was operating a brothel.
Yeah.
Because there was another female living in the building. So I've had issues with that.
Yeah.
But I've also had police officers as clients.
Well, of course.
I kicked a police officer in the balls 100 times one night. The most amazing. I actually thought at one point, here's your money back. Come and see me again.
That's brilliant. So that's, I think, the hypocrisy of it.
Because
obviously to the police, sex workers can be very vulnerable, and that means that they can be exploited. Yeah.
But this is more migrant workers. Yes. You'll find that this will happen to migrant workers and workers of colour because they're even more marginalised than white privileged sex workers. And that's the issue.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when we just coming back to people who might just be listening now or whatever, in the term sex workers, the reason why it's so important to generalise it as the industry is so that it removes any form of stigmatisation with, oh, well, you're a full service sex worker. Well, you're only a half service sex worker. Oh, you don't even sleep with men.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yes.
Yeah. It's all part of the same transactional sex.
Yeah. Hey, it's probably a good place to wrap it up. Is there anything that we haven't said that you'd want someone, anything that you wish more people understood about your lives?
Yeah, single mums and where to help. Yeah. I think that if there are any sex workers that are listening to this, that are single mums with young kids or even older kids who've experienced any form of abuse or harassment from local authorities, that there are different organisations that they can get in touch with. The English Collective of Prostitutes, the ECP, they have groups that are the first week of every month in London. They also have telephone numbers on the website that you can contact to be able to be put into somebody local in your area.
Yeah.
Because as a single mum, you know, you are vulnerable in that element, but there is support out there. You don't have to be isolated. There are people that you can talk to.
Okay, thank you. Brilliant.
I just want to say all sex workers are absolute warriors.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you so much to Charlotte Rose and Eliza Harper for talking to me so openly. Next week, I'll be having a discussion with Hallie Rubenhold, a historian who has researched the lives of the women who were murdered by Jack the Ripper, and we'll be talking about sex work in a historical context. Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends.